Case number 21-3975, James Graham et al. Versus Nelson Peltz et al. Oral argument is not to exceed 15 minutes for the appellant and 15 minutes to be shared by the appellees. Mr. Sacker for the appellant.
Thank you, and may it please the court, Roger Sacker, Newman Ferrara, LLP for the appellant. I know the court has read our briefing. I know the court is aware of the facts, and so I want to focus on two very crucial things this afternoon. One is leadership, and the second is the mediation privilege. The leadership determination rendered below was in clear error. The court allowed Faruqi to usurp leadership, settle the case, and then claim that that settlement entitled them to a formal appointment of lead. If blessed by this court, that would change the primary leadership determination from who could litigate a case to who can settle it. And let's be clear, Your Honors, there's no way Faruqi could have litigated that case. This is a poisonous tree here, and it's why this settlement is neither adequate nor fair. Step into Faruqi's shoes. After the first mediation, they know that their complaint that they're relying on that is subject to a motion to dismiss is fundamentally flawed. It's factually inaccurate and missing key allegations. So what are they going to do? The court below said, well, Mr. Sacker, they can use your complaint. But the problem is they couldn't even read our complaint, absent Wendy's okay, outside the context of the mediation. How are you going to litigate a complaint you can't even read? And they certainly couldn't file a new complaint for the exact same reason. They had to be subject to Wendy's permission to use the Section 220 materials, which were crucial and damning, in order to include them in the complaint. And we asked them.
Wendy's,
we actually put it in our opening brief.
Counsel, Wendy's granted permission, correct?
Correct. After the leadership appointment. And that is key. At the time they walked in to settle that case in the second mediation, Wendy's hadn't granted that permission. And the only option they had walking in was to settle. They could do nothing else. They had no settlement leverage. And a party who has no settlement leverage is presumptively inadequate. You can't go in, settle a case that you can't litigate. You have no
counsel. I mean, the 220.
Nothing to bring to the table.
So you're saying that there's no way under Delaware law they could, or under our rules, they could have requested the 220 documents formally after the case was filed? It's only a pre-filing?
No. In fact, there's a case in Delaware about that. It says allowing folks who don't get 220 documents and then go file just encourages a free rider problem. That's I'm probably going to butcher the name, but that's
okay. So you're, I mean, the 220 documents would have disclosed some additional facts, possibly. But it seems like the strength of the case would rise or fall on the legal question that sort of permeates all these data breach cases. In other words, you may have developed more facts by you utilizing the 220 procedure, but it felt to me like the case at the motion to dismiss level is really going to turn on sort of the legal theory. I think that's
no. We developed all the facts.
Well, okay, whatever. I mean, I don't know, is your case that much stronger because you have more facts? In other words, I thought this was a very legally intensive, the motion to dismiss would be very legally intensive, and there wasn't that much difference factually. The facts wouldn't have made that much difference in the outcome on a motion to dismiss, which is where this whole case hinged on.
I think that's incorrect, Your Honor. We showed, based on the 220 documents, the majority of the board knew a data breach was substantially likely. Faruqi could not demonstrate that. Also, I want to touch on the mediation privilege briefly. There's an admitted tug of war here between the mediation privilege and our duty of candor to the tribunal and the judge's duty of oversight. The court below held that if the allegations of misconduct occurred during the mediation, they were unreviewable. That sets a horrible precedent, opens the door to all sorts of mediation shenanigans. There are ways to protect the mediation privilege, whether it be in-camera review, oversight filings, those types of things, and still allow the court and us to fulfill their duties before the tribunal. But stating that we couldn't present anything, we couldn't present take any discovery about issues that we knew were insufficient settlement issues, meaning the reforms were not adequate, something we learned during mediation. We can't even take discovery on those issues, and then the court faults us for not presenting evidence that the settlement consideration was insufficient or that there was allegations of collusion. They're using it as a sword and a shield, and you can't use mediation privilege to shield unethical conduct.
Counsel, What specifically did you tell the court you needed to explore?
We needed to explore communications, conduct, anything that went on in the second mediation, as well as the actual reforms that were put in place as part of the second mediation, which we knew were insufficient, but could not present to the court.
Well, weren't the actual reforms part of the settlement?
There were reforms that were part of the settlement. Our contention was they were insufficient based on information that we were in possession of, but could not present.
Well, did you tell the court why you thought that they were insufficient?
No, because the reason we knew they were insufficient was information we learned during the first mediation, and the court said, you can't tell me that. So we were in between, you know, use a hackneyed expression, a rock and a hard place.
There was no sort of proffer in...
That's why we asked for relief from the mediation privilege so we could make the proffer, and the court said no.
But you didn't give the court any indication of what was deficient.
I mean, we essentially advised the court, hey, look, we know this is insufficient based on what we've done, but we can't give you specifics, Your Honor, because we're bound by this mediation privilege, and so we're asking you to give us relief so we can tell you what was wrong. And the court said no.
Okay, thank you, counsel. We'll now hear from Appellee's counsel.
You're muted, sir.
You're muted.
Hello, I'm sorry. Esteemed panel, may it please the court, my name is Stuart Goober. I represent the plaintiff appellee, James Graham. The first issue I'd like to talk about is the settlement relief. That's what this is all about today. We have created a technology committee. This is a board level committee. Wendy's has 8 committees. This is one of them, and this has the most members of any of the committees. It has 6. It is dedicated specifically to cybersecurity and other technology issues. It has its own charter, provides a reporting structure and process. But the most important thing that I see here, it addresses the precise mischief alleged in the complaint. And it also has the ability to act as a safety net also for items that had not been dealt with by Wendy's previously as well.
How is this responsive to the two arguments that your friend on the other side made? Does this go to the Rule 220 issue? Does this go to the mediation privilege issue?
Okay, I don't have much on the mediation privilege other than my experience is if you let loose all the media, if you don't have a mediator's privilege, you're not going to have too many forthright settlement negotiations because the parties will be aware that those negotiations may be public. So that's our position on that.
Well, what would have been the harm if the particular concerns were disclosed to the court and only the court?
Well, what happened in this case, they've been making these collusion arguments from the very, very inception of the case. During the litigation, they had an opportunity to put in declarations of emails that were sent to them by me. So they did have an opportunity. I believe the court below saw that one of the things that they were raising that met the collusion standard were present in that information. And so based on the previous conduct, the court was not going to let them go any further on this issue because they brought it up all day long. Now, on the collusion issue...
Counsel, I'm sorry. Was that the only claim raised below that there was collusion?
Well, they raised the issue that the settlement was illusory. They claimed we ran to the courthouse. We did not. The first inkling of a data breach occurred in January 2016. We thoroughly investigated it and didn't file our lawsuit almost a year later after the first exposure in January 2016. We didn't file until December 2016.
Counsel, with all that, can I ask you, with all that time, why you didn't make a 220 documents report?
Oh, I can definitely tell you why.
Okay,
this was a rather unique case. Unlike most of the data breach cases, what you usually have, you have a consumer lawsuit. You have a financial institutions lawsuit. They are not much help as a matter of factual development because they haven't had discovery either, just like Plaintiff Graham. But we had the advantage of the largest franchisee in the country, well over 100 franchises, who was sued by Wendy's and then put in a counterclaim that did lay out the data breach. So you had an insider litigating, and we got a lot of information from that and made a decision that because of that, this unique situation, we did not need the 220 documents to formulate.
It could be. I mean, it's the rare lawyer who doesn't ask for more information, from my experience. Most lawyers aren't so disciplined to think, well, we have enough, we're not going to ask for more. My experience is people typically employ all the bells and whistles to gather all the information they can. Maybe it was the right decision here, but in practice, it doesn't always work this way.
Agreed. I agree. We thought, based on those allegations, that we could put together a complaint that would pass muster on a motion to dismiss.
Counsel, what would have been the harm of getting the documents, of filing the 220 requests?
Well, I don't know that there would be any harm other than moving the litigation forward. We made a decision that we didn't need that because of the unique circumstances of an insider of over 100 franchisees, the largest of the country, bringing these issues in litigation. Unlike what you normally have.
Is one possible harm that it would have taken time and maybe your complaint would not have been the first one to be filed?
My complaint, Mr. Graham's complaint was filed in December 2016 after several months of investigation. We had no idea that there were other plaintiffs out there. None. So this was no race. We did not know who else was out there. We found out, of course, and we tried to alleviate the situation. And in fact, it was a demand plaintiff, Mr. Cohen, represented by a separate law firm, who tried to make peace among us. He went to Mr. Karach's counsel. He went to me as...
Do you agree, counsel? Do you agree with your friend on the other side that once you filed the case, the 220 motion under Delaware law was no longer available to you, and the complaint was basically
after I filed the litigation? I don't know. What I do know
is okay. Well, I'll assume he's right. If you don't know, then I'll assume he's right.
Well, no. The basis is that the court, in its opinion on the lead counsel issue, basically told me that I can compel this information, and two, if I wanted it as lead counsel, I was also counsel for Mr. Karachi and could have gotten them from him as well.
I think his point was that...
Knew that the court in its comments would have let me move to compel those documents.
I think his point is that you did it. You just did it really late in the game when their leverage was maybe working against you, or you're sort of seeking Wendy's good graces in exchange for maybe a more favorable settlement. And right, you did request them. It was just late in the game. At some point, you needed them because you asked Wendy's for them.
No, not at all. I was going to use every piece of information I could get a hold of.
I know, but you didn't.
I would not be doing my job, even under Rule 11, if I didn't do that. I have to make a full factual investigation and a full legal investigation. So, yes, I was going to use those documents almost no matter what. So I covered all those bases.
And you're saying...
And we also had, on the collusion issue, we had a mediator, Ralph Lee, senior partner at King & Spalding, former managing partner of that law firm. He filed a declaration. He saw no evidence of collusion, and in fact, we could not reach an agreement on fees, and what happened was Mr. Lindy, as the mediator, put forth the mediator's proposal. Now, had one of the parties not agreed to it, that case wouldn't have settled on the fees, but both parties did agree on it. And that shows, that's a real indication that there was a dispute, a real dispute over fees that indicates no collusion. I will say this. We put the settlement, the way we do things. We will settle the substantive terms first.
Counsel?
Reach an agreement in principle on
counsel,
the settlement.
Counsel?
Only then.
Counsel? You've gone over time.
We raise the issue.
Counsel?
You've gone over time. We'll hear from the other appellee's counsel at this time. Thank you.
Thank you,
panel. Thank you. Good afternoon, and may it please the court. My name is Kara Peterman. I'm with Alston & Byrd. I'm joined in the room today by my partner, John Nathan, and virtually by our co-counsel, Eric Combs, at Dinsmore & Shohl. We represent the individual defendants who are current and former officers and directors of Wendy's, as well as nominal defendant, the Wendy's Company. Your Honor, I think it's important to remind the court today that this is a shareholder derivative action that was brought against the Wendy's board for breach of their fiduciary duties, allegedly on behalf of and for the benefit of the company. The case was filed in 2016 after Wendy's disclosed that certain of its franchisee restaurants, not the company's own systems, were the victims of a third-party criminal cyber attack. But I want to make clear what this present appeal is actually about. Objector Karachi's lawyers are displeased that they were not appointed lead counsel, and they have spent years, at great expense to Wendy's, challenging a settlement that provides substantial benefits to the company and its shareholders, a settlement that was reached following several mediation sessions before an experienced third-party neutral, a settlement which was approved after multiple rounds of briefing, sworn testimony by all counsel, discovery, notice, and a fairness hearing. It can hardly be said that Appellant Karachi, the sole objector to the settlement, is still acting, quote, for the benefit of the company in bringing this appeal. Your Honors, I had planned to address, in large part, the settlement itself, which should be the primary focus, but given Mr. Sauter's desire to discuss these ancillary issues, I will address those. Mr. Sauter, I believe, would you mind going on mute? There's just some feedback on my end.
Oh.
Thank you. Your Honors, I will first discuss the leadership question. Mr. Sauter is mistaken both as the law and the facts. Both Delaware and the Sixth Circuit favor a multi-factor balancing approach, and neither jurisdiction supports a rule where the plaintiff who makes a 220 demand must be appointed lead counsel. The district court followed this multi-favor analysis in appointing Plaintiff Graham as lead here.
His argument might be more that the plaintiff who has the much stronger case has a better argument to be granted lead counsel because they're in a better position to negotiate a more favorable settlement for the shareholders. And because of the 220 demand, his case was much stronger than Mr. Graham's.
Well, 2 points, Your Honor. I think that there's, again, multiple factors. Part of it is, yes, the relative efficacy of the complaints. But part of it is, for instance, the experience
I don't disagree. I agree with the other factors. He focused on the one. So is he right about the one and the other three just outweigh it, or is he wrong about the one he emphasizes?
I think that he's wrong about both, actually, rather. First to say, the Section 220 documents are not a silver bullet. We saw no material difference, I believe that this was Judge White's question, no material difference between the two complaints. And in fact, based on our experience in Home Depot, we see that these Section 220 demands often undermine the allegations of a failure of oversight, because they demonstrate that the board and the committees were in fact evaluating these risks and acting appropriately in responding thereto. Your Honor, I just also want to add on the Section 220 documents, which have been the focus of Mr. Sacker and his client since the beginning. A, I think it's very telling that he does not say that the Section 220 documents undermine the adequacy of the settlement itself. He focused on the 220 documents only when it comes to leave and not when it comes to the settlement.
Well, I think I don't think that's quite fair. I think he says that the lead plaintiffs are in a weaker position to settle the case because they didn't have that information, and in fact they asked for it later on and the company gave it to them, but that may have been a point where there was effectively an agreement how to settle the case, so the leverage was quite different. I think that's his best argument.
I think that's his theory, Your Honor, but I'm just noting that we're actually talking about the substantive terms of the settlement, whether the settlement is fair, reasonable, and adequate. It does not say that anything in the Section 220 documents show that this settlement is inadequate. His argument is only as to process, in other words, not as
well,
to
well, he's saying he would have entered into a more adequate settlement, that this one is less adequate. If you're saying it's adequate, he's saying it's less. His would have been better, I think. I think that's what he's saying.
Yes, Your Honor, and he bases that solely on his alleged cybersecurity expert who supposedly wants other hyper-technical cybersecurity measures put in place.
I thought he based it on the fact that, again, he did more pre-suit investigation, took advantage of a pretty customary rule in shareholder litigation to ask for books and records. He had that information, and his complaint was stronger. And Graham's was weaker, so Graham was not in the same position to negotiate a settlement.
That's certainly his theory, Your Honor. I will note that in appointing the district court had both of the complaints in front of it and determined that there was no significant difference between the two, or there's no difference that cannot be ameliorated. Now, on one point, the timing of the granting of the Section 220 documents, two things. I want to note first that Mr. Gruber did have access to the Section 220 documents when we mediated, as did Mr. Cohn, the shareholder who made the demand on the board.
At what point were the documents provided to all the counsel? You say it was before the mediation, before the first mediation?
That's correct. In connection with our information sharing session that included all counsel, including Mr. Sacker.
Had there been any negotiations prior to the mediation session between any of the plaintiff's counsel and Wendy's?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the first part of that question?
Had there been any negotiations prior to the mediation between any of plaintiff's counsel and Wendy's?
Not to my recollection, Your Honor. Now, granted, this was 4 years ago, but no, we made a concerted effort to bring all the shareholders together, ask them to work collectively, ask for one settlement demand, and unfortunately, Karachi was unable to meet our requests.
So all of the counsel for the plaintiffs were on an even playing field as far as knowledge of Wendy's documents going into the mediation.
That is absolutely 100% correct. Yes, Your Honor, I can say that with certainty.
Thank you.
I do want to say one other thing about this timing.
Counsel.
I just want to clarify that everybody had those documents because of the efforts of Karachi's counsel.
I can't say that with certainty, Your Honor. We provided over 1,000 pages of documents to all of counsel in connection with the information sharing session. And certainly if those documents had been requested outside of the Section 220 context, we could have contemplated providing those as well in that situation. Your Honor, on the timing of when we granted leave to Mr. Gruber to use the documents, it's always been Wendy's position that once a lead plaintiff and a lead counsel is named, they merge through all of the rights and benefits of any shareholders. And so Mr. Sacker's speculative statement that Mr. Gruber never would have had access to those documents had we not reached a settlement and he would have had to move forward with his litigation is just that, entirely speculative and incorrect.
Counsel.
Thank you, counsel.
Your time's expired.
Well, otherwise, rest of our briefs, and thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. Is there a rebuttal?
You're muted, sir.
All right, there is a rebuttal. Sorry about that. I was on mute, which is a problem that bedevils us all. You didn't hear any response to the challenge that I raised. How are you going to litigate the case, Mr. Gruber? He didn't answer the question. Ms. Peterman got closer. She said, well, look, it's our position that once Mead is named, then we'll give everybody the documents. But that's giving it backwards. Because when Mr. Gruber went into the second mediation, he hadn't been named lead. He used the second mediation to claim he was to argue that he should be appointed lead. That was the reason the Judge Black appointed him lead, and then he got access to the documents and could use them. And that's the key. He kept hearing everybody talk about access. Access isn't the issue here. It's use. Unless you can use the documents outside of the context of mediation, they are utterly valueless to you because you can't draft a complaint using them. The only time that they got to use them to draft the complaint, once again, is after they got appointed lead.
I think it's a fair, I tend to agree with you that you obviously had access to these documents before the other plaintiffs did. But I think in your motion to consolidate, you told the district court that the cases were basically factually and legally similar. Because you wanted the case, just let me finish. Because you wanted the cases consolidated, so you're making the point that they're effectively the same case, we can put them together, which seems to be pretty counter to the point you're making now that your case was so superior.
No, not necessarily, Art. The cases themselves both arose out of the same data breach. Here's the difference. You heard Mr. Gruber talk a lot about the franchisee who apparently, was sued and there was testimony. None of that speaks to the board's knowledge. And that's the key here. The 220 materials are board materials. In those materials, we found that Wendy's board was warned years before that there would be a data breach. It was highly likely. They did nothing for years, and that if the franchisees breached, Wendy's breached. That's all in the 220 materials, none of which Mr. Gruber had, all of which demonstrate that a demand on the majority of the board, all of whom were sitting there, was futile. So there's similar allegations, right? You have a data breach. But the issue, that was never in dispute. No one ever said, oh, Wendy's, there wasn't a data breach involving Wendy's franchises. The difference between the two complaints, and this is crucial, is that ours had concrete, highly damning allegations about the board members' knowledge, involvement, and breach of fiduciary duty in the data breach. And Mr. Gruber had nothing about the board. Because no franchisee's complaint would tell you what Wendy's board knew. So it brings us right back to where we were before. How is Mr. Gruber going to litigate this case if the settlement failed? What was he going to do if the settlement was not approved? He couldn't litigate. There was no way to file a valid complaint.
At that point, he had the 220 documents, right? I think you'd give him.
No. Be very careful here. He saw the 220 documents within the context of the mediation. He then goes to the court and said, Justice Black, I've settled this. Appoint me lead. After he was appointed lead, then he got the documents. At the time of the leadership determination, there was no way for Mr. Gruber to litigate the case. That is really important. You can't appoint someone lead who can litigate the case, who can't litigate the case.
It's not that he couldn't litigate it. You're just saying you were in a better position to litigate it. At the end of the day, he did get the documents. Couldn't he have amended his complaint? Suppose the settlement fell apart. Didn't happen. couldn't he have amended his complaint to strengthen it, or if the case was dismissed without prejudice, refiled with stronger factual allegations?
After he was appointed lead, yes, I suppose he could. But at the time of the leadership determination, which is the key thing, there is no indication that outside of the context of mediation, Mr. Gruber was entitled to view and use these documents. That's the key.
Do you have a case that says that such a person cannot be named lead counsel based on other factors?
No, it's not, and in this, Ms. Peterman was right, it's not just getting 220 documents is not the end-all deal. But here, everything else was equal, and the Dental Report strongly favored folks who get 220 documents. I am unfamiliar, frankly, of any case where someone was appointed lead that, against someone who had had access to 220 documents. There's only cases where like people who are supporting the leadership have had access to it. So if I file without 220, someone comes along and says, I support, you know, Joe's law firm leadership, I have the 220 documents. I'm not aware of any case where leadership was appointed against someone who had Section 220 documents and on behalf of someone who did not.
Are you aware of any case where a lead counsel appointment was overturned on appeal based on any facts that are even remotely analogous to what we have here?
No, frankly, the straight answer is no, because we've never seen anything like this. Usually what happens is when you go into, you don't do a mediation before a lead counsel is appointed. Usually you don't do that. We did that here because we couldn't agree on a leadership structure, and that's why we went into the first mediation. So this is frankly unique, but it's the problem is that if the court decides that the ability to settle a case is an important leadership factor that trumps 220, it's not going to be unique anymore. You're going to see this all over the place. Mm.
The appointment question that the district court had here, was that a question of state law or federal law?
I would say it's a question of Delaware law.
Okay. And you don't find any Delaware, there's no Delaware authority that places emphasis on one attorney's access to documents over another attorney in determining whether to appoint who the lead counsel will be?
No, to the contrary, there is lots of Delaware authority that says that there's a strong presumption in favor of 220 docs, in favor of 220 plaintiffs. It's the universal case we cited in our brief.
Do you have any case from Delaware where an appointment was reversed based upon not appointing the counsel who had the 220 documents?
No, I'm not, but I am not aware of any case where that has been reversed.
Wouldn't that suggest that it's a matter of discretion by the trial judge?
Yes,
that it's not to be disturbed?
Frankly, no Delaware vice chancellor or chancellor I don't think would ever have appointed a settling plaintiff as lead over a 220 plaintiff. And in fact, you know, we pointed in our brief this universal decision from Delaware that says Section 220 demands are strongly enough encouraged under Delaware law to be a plus factor for those leadership applicants who avail themselves. And that's key, Your Honor. It's a plus factor.
I guess a plus factor. There's some negative factors, too, for you, for your side. One, you didn't participate in the second round of negotiations, right? The other two plaintiffs did, but you opted not to participate. And you're fairly aggressive in your request for attorney's fees, I think 90%.
I disagree that we were fairly aggressive, Your Honor. I think Mr. Gruber was fairly aggressive, trying to get an equal share of the pie for not doing a proper amount of work. It's not, you know, my experience.
Okay, that's a jump ball. That sounds like a jump ball to me, and this is an abuse of discretion standard. So I could see the district court looking at that either way very fairly. You might agree with you. You know, we might think you're probably best. You know, if I was a judge, maybe I would decide with you. Maybe I agreed with Judge Black. But in this abuse of discretion context, that to me sounds like a jump ball that reasonable people could go either way.
I don't view it that way, Your Honor. But you're up there and I'm down here.
Well, it's also true that you also didn't participate in the second mediation. And Was that something fair for the district court to consider?
That we didn't part, well, yes, it was fair to consider, but the problem was the terms that were offered to us. We shouldn't be faulted for not agreeing to an extortionate demand that is beyond the realm of what any other attorney would ask for. And it basically said, look, if you don't participate in the settlement negotiation, we're going to settle around you. And the conditions to participate in that is you got to give me an equal cut because Mr. Latham and I are buddy buddies. We're Atlanta guys.
Well, you still could have participated. I mean,
then we weren't allowed to participate unless there was that agreement walking through the door.
Okay, counsel.
In terms of Judge Wadler mentioned being fairly aggressive, it wasn't just in the allocation of the fees, it was in the fee itself, right?
No, look, Justice Black has this rule, which to my knowledge is unique, where if you are going to ask him to award fees, you have to put in all your time. You have to send that to your adversary. I've never seen that in any other case. And of course, we put in every hour with a caveat that was not what we were seeking in fees. And in any event, at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter because the court has fee oversight. The court can decide if the court thinks our hours are aggressive, fine, mark them down. We often submit fee requests that don't account for every hour. In fact, I do that in every single case. We weren't there yet. We weren't making a fee application to the court. I think it was unfair to consider that.
What were you finally awarded in fees?
What were we awarded? Zero.
Okay, so you only Graham's attorneys got fees, you got none?
We got zero. $0.
Well, didn't the third plaintiff's lawyers also get fees? The other party that participated in the settlement?
You'd have to ask Mr. Guber. I don't recall if it's been a while. I don't recall if Plaintiff Cohen's counsel got fees. I know they didn't get an incentive award for the client, but I don't recall that off the top of my head.
Okay, any other questions? Okay.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We will take the case under submission, and the clerk may adjourn the court.